an endless darkness beyond all time? The shaman didn't know. Very, very cautiously, he eased open his dark brown eyes.
Nothing.
As he spoke to himself, he was conscious of how harsh and dry his voice sounded, as though it hadn't been used for several days.
Nothing has happened here at all.
They seemed to be exactly where they'd been when Ryan Cotter, known to the Indians people as One Eye Chills, had closed the ponderous door. His new companions sat or lay just where they'd been before the swooping Raven of Blackness had come and plucked away his mind for a while. The metal discs in the floor and the ceiling were no longer glowing, and the tendrils of pale mist had long evaporated. The shaman recalled a distant humming that had seemed to come simultaneously from inside and outside the chamber, and it hurt the head. He sighed, swallowing to clear the pressure in his ears. Then he noticed that something was different. Even though the six-sided room looked precisely the same, the walls had changed color. When they'd entered the gateway in New Mexico, the glass walls had been a rich golden hue. Now they were a deep turquoise, tinted like old Navajo jewelry.
You all right?
Man Whose Eyes See More nodded, regretting the sharp movement and the pain it caused him.
I am not yet dead.
Good.
The Apache knew that the speaker, John Barrymore Dix, was a man of very few words, never using two when one would be enough. Short and wiry, J.B. was the armorer of the traveling group of friends that the shaman had joined. His sallow face rarely showed any emotion, unless he was talking about blasters, about weapons of any sort. His blue eyes would glitter behind his wire-rimmed spectacles, and he would push back the brim of the battered fedora he habitually wore. He could tell you all there was to know about rifles, carbines, automatics, revolvers, and muskets. Next to J.B., whom the Indians had christened Weapons Strike Fear, was the slumped and unconscious figure of a boy. Eyes of Wolf had been his name, but the Mescalero knew his proper name was Jack Lauren. He was only 3 inches over 5 feet in height, nearly 2 feet below Man Whose Eyes See More's towering 7 feet, and weighed in at 105 pounds. The boy's eyes were ruby red, and his hair was as pure white as the snow that dappled the high peaks of the distant Sierras. In his lap, Jack was clenching a massive .357 Magnum with a 6-inch barrel. He was a brilliant hand-to-hand fighter who the Indian knew had killed an amazing number of men. He also knew that Jack Lauren was just 14 years old. Feeling a little better, the shaman stretched out his long legs, bare feet scraping on the floor of the chamber. He was wearing his favorite pair of pants, seersucker, with one leg missing. His brocade vest had a cherry red kerchief dangling from it, and he sported a silver stick pin and a scarlet cravat, its claw setting empty of a stone. The shaman's own decorated 50 caliber Sharps buffalo rifle lay at his side. Next around the chamber, lying together, both showing the first signs of recovery, were the two women in the group. Man Whose Eyes See More came from a warrior society where women came third or fourth best, if they came anywhere at all. The woman who moaned was Christy Roth, called Firehair Woman by the Mescalero. Man Whose Eyes See More was a priest of the Apache, with a mutie power of seeing a little into the future, of sensing things that others couldn't see. He knew that this woman with the bizarre, fiery crimson hair also had something of that doomy power. She was tall, close to 6 feet, and was dressed in khaki coveralls. Her feet, pointed toward the shaman, were shod in dark blue leather cowboy boots that had chiseled heels and were ornamented with silver spread-wing falcons. The sharp toes were also silver. Her pistol was plated and polished, a Heckler & Koch P7A-13 9mm blaster that fired 13 rounds. And the Apache had first-hand knowledge that the girl knew how to use her gun. Although he would never admit it out loud, he was a little scared of Christy Roth. As he looked at her, she blinked, opening the startling green eyes, managing a smile.
Hey there. Enjoy your first jump with us?
No.
Maybe you should have stayed where you were, Shaman.
Jack sat up, a thin string of bile dribbling from his slack lips and dripping onto the front of his canvas camouflage jacket. He shook his head, the long white hair floating around his narrow skull like winter smoke.
That's to jump. Makes me feel ill every time.
The other girl also sat up, burying her face in her hands. She was one of the most beautiful women the Apache had ever seen. Indeed, on the strength of that, she had been gifted by the Apache with the name of Keeps Night Warm. Her Anglo name was Lori Quint, and she was in her 16th year of life. She was even taller than Christy Roth, topping the 6-foot mark by close to an inch. Lori was a startling blonde with blue eyes. She smoothed her dark navy cut and skirt over her long thighs.
Ugh. Jump always make me feel like muty shit.
Ugh. How you feeling?
This was the leader of the small group, Ryan Cotter. He was an imposing sight, built like the killing machine that he was. The man stretched 2 inches above 6 feet, weighing just on 200 pounds. His right eye was a deathly melt-ice blue, the left hidden beneath a patch of black leather. A savage scar furrowed his face from his right eye to the corner of his mouth. Both injuries, the Indian knew, were the result of a deadly fight between Ryan and an older brother.
My head is still in space. I will be pleased when it catches up with the other parts of me.
Doc's still out cold. He usually takes it harder than the rest of us.
Doc Tanner was the last member of the group, someone whom the shaman found disturbing. Normally, his seeing power enabled him to weigh up strangers, but not the gray-haired, skinny old man in the green mottled frock coat and cracked knee boots. When Man Whose Eyes See More talked with Doc, he had the feeling that he was seeing a misty, unreal person. He had refused to allow Doc to carry an Indian name, and the old man hadn't seemed unduly surprised. From hints dropped by the others, the shaman suspected that Doc Tanner had come somehow from another time. And the Apache was right. Dr. Theophilus Algernon Tanner had been born in South Stratford, Vermont, on the 14th day of February in the year of our Lord, 1868. Married, the father of 2 young children, a leading scientist of his time, Doc had been trawled forward to the year 1998. He was the first, and as far as he knew, the only successful subject of a time travel experiment, which was a part of the infamous Cerberus Project. Because he had caused the 20th century scientists such trouble, they used him once more as the unwilling subject for an experiment. This time they sent him forward to the bleak scenario of the Deathlands, nearly 100 years in the future. By a fluke of good or bad luck, Doc was cron-jumped only a couple of weeks before the fire and light that swept so much of the United States clean of life and living. Ryan Cotter had rescued him from the Ville of Moxon up in the darks, saved from Baron Jordan Teague and his supremely evil sect boss, Cort Strasser. In recent bloody fighting, with Ryan and his companions siding with Man Whose Eyes See More and the Mescalero against killers in cavalry uniforms, the wheel had come full circle. The gang of butchers had been led by Cort Strasser. Gradually, all 7 within the glass-walled chamber managed to struggle to their feet. Doc was the last to come around, helped up by Lori on one side and young Jack on the other.
By the 3 Kennedys, I fear that I am too far gone in years to relish this Matran's jumping. The blackness grows ever deeper, and my heart sinks when I think of all the jumps to come.
Maybe there won't be any more jumps, Doc.
Sure. This might be the very place in all the Deathlands where we can find what we're looking for. Maybe a place with a future.
And maybe pigs fly, was what Fowler used to say.
Ignoring Jack's attempt at